Welcome to LOA Today. Walt Thiessen and Life Coach Wendy Dillard here. Today is Friday, March 16th, 2018, 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Your second daily dose of happy for the day, and it's time once again to celebrate TGIF. Hooray! The weekend is here. Of course, we celebrate every day, but we celebrate a little extra on Friday because Friday's just a little bit extra.
Yeah. But and I have a massage scheduled for tomorrow, so yeah, Friday is the day before the massage, so Friday's an exciting day for me.
Okay. Well, you know, it's nice to have something like that to look forward to. It not only does it help you get through the more sticky spots during the week, but when you actually get there, it's like, oh, thank goodness.
Absolutely.
It is a beautiful thing, for sure. I was... I wanted to be working on the book today and did do a little bit, but I'm afraid I had to put it aside for a bit because Louise's gardening business needs a new brochure. So today was brochure day. But that was the good part because the brochure is almost done. I just need one more piece of text from her and a photo, and it's ready to send off to the printer. So it was a good day from that perspective. And that's the way I am ending the week. And... Mm-hmm. You said I shouldn't mention this, so I'm not really mentioning the fact that we may be ending this part in the book. Oh, no, I didn't say that.
You just can't help yourself, Mr. Walt. You just can't.
What do you mean I can't help myself? I think I did a very good job.
Well, you can't help yourself from saying, you know, where we are in relation to the relationship to the end of this section. But, you know, I have a big question because you were the person who started us with this book.
Okay.
And we didn't start at the very beginning.
No, we didn't. No, we skipped the preface or whatever it is.
Oh, okay. So yeah. Where did we start? Did we start at the beginning of section two?
I think we started with the foreword, but we skipped the preface. And then when we got to part one, I think we just kind of, we did some skipping through stuff because we didn't really want to rehash all of the prehistory leading up to why Jerry and Esther were doing what they did. But I honestly can't remember the details because that was so many years ago. We've been in part two forever, so.
I'll bet we started on at part two. I'm kind of looking at it. So.
Well, no, I remember we started with the foreword because the foreword was Neil Donald Walsh. And that was the one where he basically did this really great thing about how this is the first and last book you need. You can just throw the rest of them away.
Okay, but then I think we jumped because I'm looking at the stuff that comes after that, and we didn't cover those things. That was kind of like Esther's story.
Right, exactly.
That's the part that we skipped.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, all the stuff that led up to who they became as the Chandler and the Questioner of Abraham.
Gotcha.
Oh, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said the word Chandler. She's a receiver.
Receiver.
I'm sorry about that. Sorry, Esther. That was unintentional.
Well,
it was a blip.
I do that too because, like, I think there's too many people that freak out over the word channeling, and that's just a word that somebody made up, and then it got a bad rap. I personally love the word Esther prefers, which is receiver, because that's how I feel. Like when I receive guidance from my inner being, I wouldn't say I'm channeling from my inner being. I'm receiving guidance. I'm receiving insight. I'm just receiving information. So I like the word receiving.
Plus, with channeling, there's always the chance that you have the wrong channel on. So,
oh, Walt, you are silly today on this Friday.
I also just dated myself because there haven't actually been channels on TV for a long time. So today it's just, you know, I guess they call them channels, but it's like on 252 or HBO or whatever. You know, it's not, there aren't channels anymore. It used to be back in the day when you had a manual rotating channel dial. That was a channel, you know, but no longer.
Oh, and I remember when I got my first TV that had push button channels.
Oh my goodness. Gosh,
that was so exciting. And you had to push the numbers. So if you wanted channel 11, you'd have to push 1 twice.
Yeah,
if you wanted channel 8, you'd have to put 08. But that was like a big deal. So,
do you remember your first TV remote?
My first TV remote.
Or the first time that you had one?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Because the first TV I ever purchased for myself was in 1987. And it did not, it had a wired remote.
Oh, yeah. Wow, that's really old. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was like a, or I take it back, maybe that was like a non-remote and my next TV was a wired remote, and then it went to like a remote with batteries. So yeah,
Okay.
I've been through the gamut.
One of Louise's favorite stories is to talk about how she has a lot of stories about the cat she had in the earlier years of her young adult life, a cat named Shadow. And she's even written part of a little book called Me and My Shadow about those little stories. One of the stories she likes to tell is how Shadow never became a lap cat because whenever he tried to settle in her lap while she was watching TV, she had to get up and go turn the channel and then come sit back down again. So he just kind of gave up after a while.
Oh my goodness. My
Oh,
goodness.
yes.
And I mean, when I think about it now, I don't know how we lived without remotes. I mean, I know we did. I had taken a picture of my bedroom suite for one of my friends. She wanted to see what it looked like when I bought it new. And she doesn't remark on the furniture. She goes, "Oh my gosh, you have so many remotes on your
Yeah, well,
"Well, what'd you think of the furniture? Oh, yeah,
that's right.
that was Oh, but then they came out with universal remotes.
Oh, yes.
But then eventually more devices came and more devices came, and the universal remote no longer could handle all the functionality of all the remotes. So I gave up on universal remotes.
I'm probably just feeling nostalgic. That's got to be what it is, because I keep thinking to myself, there was one advantage to having, I mean, I wasn't big on watching TV anyway, but there was advantage to having the tuner on the TV where you had to get up and go change the channel. And that is that today, I'll use my wife as an example. She has herself ensconced most days during the off season in a corner of the couch. We have one of these what do you call them? Sectional couches. And she has herself in the corner, and she's got her TV table there, and she's got her laptop and the remotes and the screens over there. And she's just set for the day. She just, she's pushing remotes, she's pushing keys on her keyboard, and she never moves. She
Yeah,
just
she's
stays right
created a
there.
nest and it's
She's created a
perfect.
nest, exactly. And I think to myself, really, you could get up sometime.
Well, that's who we've become as a society.
That's why I like my walks. It gets me out. It gets me and about, It's just like, no, I don't want to be a couch potato. It's not for me. Sorry. Anyway.
Well, I believe in couch potato time when it feels good.
Oh, okay. Well, if it floats your boat, then there you go. That's all you need. After all, it's about feeling the joy anyway. So we are talking about the last subsection of part two of the Law of Attraction, the basics of the teachings of Abraham. And we might as well just jump right into it because this one is named What is the Measure of Our Success? And based on our conversation so far, I'd have to say the measure of our success is how long we can stay in the corner of the sectional couch without moving.
Well, that's one type of success, but there are others.
Oh, there are others. Oh, okay, good. Let's see what Jerry's question is. He says, what do you see as success, Abraham? What would you say is the mark of success?
And Abraham says, the achievement of anything. You know what? I'm going to let you do this because I'm coughing on and off.
Oh,
So I'm
okay.
not going to get
Well, you get yourself a sip of water. I'll do the reading here. So Abraham says,
through this. Okay.
the achievement of anything that you desire must be considered success, whether it is a trophy, money, relationships, or things. But if you will let your standard of success be your achievement of joy, everything else will fall easily into place. For in the finding of joy, you are finding vibrational alignment with the resources of the universe. You cannot feel joy while you are focusing upon something not wanted or the lack of something wanted. Therefore, while you are feeling joy, you will never be in the state of contradicted vibration. That's a good thing. And only the contradiction in your own thoughts and vibration can keep you from the things you desire. Now, we are amused as we watch the majority spending most of their life seeking a set of rules against which they can measure their life experience, looking outside of self for those who will tell them what is right or wrong, when all along they have within themselves a guidance system that is so sophisticated, so intricate, so precise, so readily available. And by paying attention to this emotional guidance system and by reaching for the best feeling thought that you can find right now from wherever you are, you will allow your broader perspective to help you move in the direction of the things that you truly want. So as you sift through the magnificent contrast of your physical time-space reality, consciously aware of the way you feel and deliberately guiding your thoughts toward those that feel better and better, in time, you begin to see your life through the eyes of your broader inner being. And as you do so, you feel the satisfaction of being upon the path that you chose from your non-physical perspective when you made the decision to come forth into this wonderful body. For from your non-physical vantage point, you understood the eternally evolving nature of your being and the promise that this leading-edge contrasting environment held. You understood the nature of your magnificent guidance system and how with practice you could see this world as your inner being sees it. You understood the powerful law of attraction and the fairness and accuracy with which it responds to the free will of all creators. And by reaching for the best feeling thought you can find, you reconnect with that perspective and you will shiver with exhilaration as you reconnect with your purpose, with your zest for life, and with you. Shiver. I'm shivering when I read this. Wow.
Are you really, or are you just playing?
when I got to the word, yeah, I was like, whoa, there was like this little shiver that went up my spine. I mean, I take this stuff pretty seriously. And I mean, this is kind of a summary subsection. It kind of summarizes what we've been talking about throughout part two. But this stuff is cool. I mean, we spent a lot of time kind of rehashing it in a lot of different ways from a lot of different perspectives. But this whole thing about having power that we didn't know we had until we started learning about this is cool. I don't care what anybody says. This is just cool stuff to be able to learn this.
So give me more specifics on what's cool to you.
Specifically, for most of my life, I have tried to do what I was taught to do, both in school and by parents and by other adults who were, you know, the mentors of my life, so to speak, in terms of trying to have a most successful life, because that's what that little subsection was about. You know, what is the measure of success? And success was about getting a good job and working hard and being rewarded for it. And as you were rewarded, you would kind of move up the scale, so to speak, and you'd have a nice home. You'd have the marriage and the 2.3 kids and, you know, the whole American dream thing. And what actually happened was so far away from that that I actually felt cheated for a while. Leading up to the point where I first discovered how the law of attraction worked and even what it was called, up until that point, I was to the point where I felt like I was haunted. I felt like that, you know, there was somebody who was out to get me, because every time that I would do something or, you know, work on something and try to build it up, somebody would tear it down for me. And I'd say, how many times did that actually happen just in my business life alone? It happened in 96, 2000, 2001, 2003 or 4, I can't remember which one, and then 2008, and 2013 or 14. So it happened like, what, 4, 5, 6 times, something like that, where
I lost track. So what happened?
Oh, these were like various businesses that I set up, that I got them going, I started building them, and then, you know, some unlucky event, we'll put it that way, would come along. So for instance, I built up one of my earliest web businesses was a business that sold long distance services. And I built that up. I had a nice income built up that I never collected. And I never collected because, I collected some of it. But most of it I never collected because most of it was through, I'll say the name, MCI. MCI, I had agencies for a variety of companies that either sold directly for MCI or resold MCI services. And ultimately, most of those got rolled right back into MCI. So basically, it was all working for MCI. And then MCI declared bankruptcy in 2001. And considered they went to the bankruptcy court and said, we want to be free of all the obligations we owe to all the agents who build up our business. And bankruptcy court said, well, yeah, you don't have any assets. So sure, okay, they're done. And thus, I lost all the money I had built up. I had built up this huge book of business, and I didn't get rewarded for it.
So because you didn't get rewarded for it, and based on how society thinks of things, did you think of yourself as a not successful person in that?
That's an interesting question. Based on the way society thought about it, I said, yes, I was not successful. to answer your question. But okay. Based on the way I felt about it, I felt like I had actually achieved something. It had just been taken away from me. So I felt like I'd been robbed.
So you'd been robbed of your success.
Yeah, that's the way it felt. And I didn't know any better, so that's what I assumed had happened. Now, I also understand how economics works. I understand, you know, companies go out of business and so forth. And quite honestly, I had set myself up because I had signed these agreements that allow the MCI to get away with that. You know, the wordings were in there. Not that I had a whole lot of choice. It was either sign the agreements and sell the business or don't sign the business and, you know, forget it. You're out of here. It was like you either sign or forget it. So I signed and then they forgot it.
So what would you say how you measured yourself in terms of being successful or not successful? What things were you using to determine your success?
To the degree that I said that I was successful, I had built a website that was able to, at least in most cases, capture the information and give me a way to transmit it to the company in a relatively painless manner compared to the way it used to be. Because it used to be you had to sign papers and send stuff through the mail, and there was all kinds of stuff to sign and you know, I's to dot and T's to cross. And I had managed to reduce some of that clutter through the electronics of being on the web. So I was kind of an early adopter of that kind of technology. And I felt good that I had done that.
You created something that you felt good about.
Yeah.
And so you called yourself successful in that.
Because of that, yeah. I had succeeded in doing that. Yep.
Okay. That's interesting because, you know, I'm thinking about Oprah and how when she was 8 years old, she was in a classroom and she was constantly getting in trouble by her teachers because she was always talking and she was constantly being told, shut up, you need to be quiet.
Oh, right. And yeah, I've heard that.
You know, in parent teachers conferences, it was like, Oprah is a disruption in the classroom. She's never going to amount to anything, you know, because she, in this respect, she was a rule breaker.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ironic because, you know, she was on her show on ABC for a number of years when she said, oh, yeah, my teacher so-and-so, she said I'd never amount to anything because I couldn't shut up. But look at me now.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And to me, that's a wonderful example of how her success as a young child was being measured on what society thought was appropriate rules in a classroom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, she got her own sense of, hey, I'm successful now because I'm doing the thing that I love to do. Ha, ha, ha. But, you know, rarely are we taught from young children that, you know, like a small age, that a real measure of success is how do we feel in any given moment?
That's
because,
true.
You know, even somebody who has won a gold medal, it's possible under certain circumstances in their life for them not to feel successful.
Oh, yeah.
They might have thought, you know what? I should have done better.
Yeah.
I know I got the gold, but in my own mind, I felt I should have done better. I should have, you know, crossed the finish line 0.002 seconds sooner. And so it really, everything about how we relate to what is successful has to do with how we feel about it.
Mm-hmm. It's true. In fact, I know of at least two snowboarders who became very, very successful and had exactly that kind of crisis. I mean, one of them comes to mind immediately after winning the gold medal at the Olympics. This person became suicidal. Not exactly the result you would expect. You know,
but I mean, rock stars go through that. Child celebrities go through that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many different circumstances where success, as society sees it or the media, you know, pictures it, does not equate to success in the person's individual life and
That's
how
right.
they feel about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it also shows how subjective it is. It depends on what's your viewpoint. From the viewpoint of society, I never did figure out who society was, but apparently society does have a viewpoint. And from that viewpoint, first of all, I have to say society's batting average is terrible. Have you ever noticed that? The rules of society and how society measures success, when you compare that to how often individuals actually have success or how often individuals end up behaving the way society wants them to behave in order to produce a certain result, the batting average of how often that actually works out well is really low. I mean, in some cases, it's like 1 out of 10 or something like that, which is a 100 batting average. That wouldn't even get you to Class D ball. I mean, it's just really, really bad. And yet, we keep looking to society for our gauges so often. It continues to fascinate me just how bad that track record really is.
Well, and society could be anyone that's not us.
Yes, right. That's the other thing.
You know, it's so broad, it's so generic, it's kind of like they in quotes. It's like they say, well, who is they?
Yeah,
well,
right.
We'll never know. You know, or like I'll read an article, let's say one day online, and I'll just have the thoughts of whatever that article said in my head. And what happens then is it morphs into the overall consensus that I believe that
That's
others
right.
think about a certain topic. And I, you know, it's easy for any one of us to go, oh, well, you know what they're saying. And I'll just talk about one particular, you know, article where it's just one particular author. And all of a sudden they is based on one person that I just happen to read his data. But, you know, we turn things into something so much more than it really is, you know, and if we get more I-centric, as in like, here's what I'm thinking based on what I read and how I conclude, that kind of gets it down to more of my own, more realistic in terms of, because when we make things out there really big and bold, it can really weigh on us. And
we're turning ourselves into victims,
yeah,
really.
We compare ourselves against this big them, this big they, this big, you know, society. And the truth is, it might be nothing more than one person's thought or opinion.
Oh, yeah. Well, it always is. Actually, I don't think there are ever any exceptions to that. It's always somebody else's opinion. And
right.
That,
but
that's
like
the problem.
If you listen to news media, let's say about a specific something, whether it's a war effort or, you know, a weather issue or, you know, a police riot or whatever it is, you know, it's like you could go across multiple media channels and read similar things.
Oh, yeah.
So there are lots of voices talking about the same thing. So that's more than one person talking about it. But there are times it might just be one person. It could be one YouTube and it's gone viral and it's had 3 million views. So it's really just one person, but now a whole bunch of people have gone look at what that one person has done. And now it's a bigger thing because, well, if 3 million people are watching, maybe 3 million people are in agreement.
That's one reason I'm glad that here on the show, most days we do the wins for the day. And you may be wondering, what's the connection? Excuse me. The connection is that when you do a win, you're talking about your own success from your own perspective. So no matter how small that win is, just the fact that it happened in your life and that you saw it as a win and that you saw it from your perspective as something worthy of mention makes it, interestingly enough, worthy of mention. Not only worthy of mention, but worthy of attention. And indeed, the act of, you know, going through this exercise of, you know, describing what the win was or describing what went well or what was the good thing that happened today or whatever it is, it relives it. Or more precisely, you relive it as you're telling it, as you're talking about it, as you're thinking about it. And in that way, you end up making it a true success where you were the person who was directly involved in the success. So we just eliminated two very, very potentially damaging factors. Number one, it was somebody else out there outside of your control. And number two, we don't know who they are. Well, we do know who it is. It was you, and you were the one who was in control, and you win. That's like a billion times more powerful and more important, in my view. So I actually have gotten to the point where I laugh at the collective wisdom. I sometimes shake my head at it. I sometimes roll my eyes at it. I very rarely say, wow, I really respect that. Most of the time, it's just my way of saying, you know what? I'm not going to take my cues from that anymore. It's just I'm going to take the cues from. I'm going to take the cues from my own success.
Like if you're talking to, like if I'm saying, like you, Walt, if you are talking to a group of people and you want to share a concept or an idea, do you generally talk in the first person, like everything you're talking about, you're saying from your perspective, or if you're, and I guess what I'm trying to get to is so often I listen to people talking about, well, you know, when you go through this kind of an experience and you've had something happen to such and such, then you tend to do X, Y, Z. And I'm thinking, they're talking about themselves and they're talking about their own personal experience.
But they're doing it in the second
person. Speaking in the third No, you're right. Second person. No, third person.
A third is would be somebody else. Second would be the person you're talking to.
Well, but they're talking about you as in the global you.
Yeah.
Okay. As in we, as in multiple people. I think that's the third person.
Okay. In the case, at that point, we're third person. Yeah. Okay.
But what always astounds me is, like, especially if it's on an interview, if the interview is asking them about what they just went through, they don't talk in first person. They talk in a plural person.
Yeah.
Which, to me, makes it less personalized. It's like somebody's not owning their feelings because they're putting it outside of themselves into the global we, into the global you-ness of life.
Sure. Yeah.
And I wonder if that's a part of what we're talking about when we're talking about them.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think we've really learned how to own our own stuff and then speak from our own personal experience.
Yeah, I certainly agree that it's very often, especially when you're talking about something that might have some controversial aspect to it, or you know, people might have trouble with it or whatever, I will, like anybody else, I will talk in the third person, but I also try to remember to talk in the first person, because I understand that when you're talking in the first person, most often that gets taken as me expressing my opinion. So if I'm saying it from my perspective, people will take that as oh, okay, well, that's his opinion, that's fine. Whereas if I try to say it in the third person, then people start to say, well, he's trying to just declare that to be an across the board fact that's objectively true. So I find that it's a safer position, when especially when I'm touching on something that might have some controversy, people might, you know, not feel comfortable about it, to do it in the first person, because it takes a lot of the angst away from it.
You know, if my mother's listening, she probably will not remember this, but it was a very significant experience for me. Many, many years ago, when I had gotten into traditional therapy, one of the things my therapist was helping me to do is on this subject, which is stop talking in the third person and start talking in the first.
Okay.
And she wanted me to start feeling what I was feeling, because I was very disconnected from my feelings. And I was with her for about 4 years, and after a good while, I started making it a practice where instead of saying, well, you know how you feel when you blah, 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 well, I'd say, when I did blah, 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 this is how I felt. And I was owning the experience instead of just kind of couching it out there outside of myself. And so it's kind of like, you know, whenever you learn something new, you kind of do a pendulum swing. You go from one extreme to another, and you keep doing that until you kind of land somewhere in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was pretty much at a point that almost every statement I made started with I, blah, 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 I, blah, 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 because it was really a profound thing for me to start learning how to own my experiences. So
sure.
I was owning it by using the word I.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now here's the part that I think my mother won't remember. But one day she had a real problem with me in that she said, I think you've become a humanist, which I didn't even know what that meant. But to her, it was like a religion outside of the one that I had grown up in.
Mm-hmm.
And she was afraid I was now going to go to hell. And I went, whoa, where are you coming up with this stuff? So she was so upset that we would not spend eternity together.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what on earth have I said or done that has caused you to believe that I'm no longer a believer and that I'm a humanist, whatever that might be? And she said, because you use the word I so much.
Oh, my
went,
goodness.
Wow. And what that says to me in this context of what we're talking about today, that's how foreign my languaging had become to her.
Wow.
So it's like, to me, that was kind of a something I marked in my time and space to go, wow, society as a whole did not train me to speak in the first person or to own my feelings or own my experiences, because it was much more natural to talk in the third person or just kind of generalities. And that's what my mother was more comfortable with. But when I'd say, well, I feel this, or this is what I've experienced, that made her really, really uncomfortable, which was kind of surprising to me.
Well, I can't say it's surprising, but it certainly is extremely noteworthy, because I think it is very significant. It doesn't surprise me because I've heard the same kind of overall sentiment expressed by a number of people who are very, very religious, to the point of perhaps even being either evangelical or born again or something along that line. And I think it has to do with the way Christianity is taught by the pastors of the churches that they're members of. Because, I mean, depending on how you can read the Bible any way you want to, really. And people do. People read it all kinds of different ways. But one of the most prevalent ways, one of the most common ways to read it, is to interpret the idea that man is so small, man is basically just a creature and the plaything of God. That's not the way they express it, but that's what it amounts to. And because of that, if man starts to express any kind of an ego or any kind of a strong self-identity, he's going against the will of God, which I think is a pretty extreme explanation of what the Bible teaches. But, you know, then again, I disagree with almost everything that's taught about the Bible. So, you know, why should I stop there? But I just see that, and I just continue to be amazed by it. The fact that it's there, but I'm not surprised anymore, because I hear it so often from that sector that, there's something wrong with you if you have so much ego. You know, that's like almost a sin, which is really something.
And for me, I never even thought about how I was talking in terms of ego. I was only aware of what I was being taught through my therapist. Of Wendy, you have not been connected to your feelings, and how we're going to get you connected is by you owning your experience and by you owning what you feel. So I want you to use the word I and be in the first person and get present, you know, to what you're going to talk about.
And by the way, here's a really interesting thing. Now, I was talking about, we could just kind of call it like the religious right, but the same phenomenon exists on the left, and it exists in the camp that you were accused of being a member of. The secular humanist, because that same camp also believes that there are far too many egotistical people in the world, and the last thing you want to be is egotistical. The last thing you want to do is demonstrate ego. You should be working for the greater good. They both believe in working for the greater good, just for completely different metaphysical reasons, but nevertheless, they come to the same conclusion.
So, this might sound really elementary, but when you said secular humanist,
yeah,
do you think that's what my mother was referring to when she called me a humanist?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I could be wrong, but anytime I've ever heard,
had she said the words secular humanist, that probably would have been more of a pronounced awareness and understanding, because as a Christian, that using the word secular was like anti-Christian.
Yeah, right.
But she didn't use the word secular. She only used the word humanist, to which I had no idea what that meant. And so I really felt like I was out in left field, which, just for anybody who's concerned about my mother and my relationship, a couple of years later, we had this discussion. She said she didn't even remember ever talking about this. And no, she was no longer fearful of us spending eternity apart.
Which is a great thing. We're so happy for that. That's fabulous.
I just thought, just in case somebody feels like I've just left them hanging, it's all good.
I mean, there are a lot of definitions about what humanism are. I mean, you can look them up on Google. Secular humanism is basically humanism with an associated belief. I'll read this one from Google because I just looked it up. Secular humanism is humanism with regard, in particular, to the belief that humanity is capable of morality and self-fulfillment without belief in God. So that's why the religious right particularly hate secular humanism. I mean, humanism is bad enough, but secular humanism, that's basically, you know, throwing tomatoes at God. And you can't do that, obviously.
Got it. And it's all about me, and all power is in me. Okay.
Exactly.
Now it kind of makes sense, this many gazillions of years later. Thank you for helping me
You're welcome.
Get some understanding on that situation.
The other interesting thing about humanism is that there are a lot of people who hurl the label humanist at others as if it were some sort of a curse, which is really interesting. Because, first of all, I'm not sure there's any single definition of humanism. And second of all, what's the root of humanism? It's human. So,
well, I mean,
being human is a curse.
I know that I'm human because I was born into this human reality. I love knowing that I'm a powerful human and that I am a co-creator with my inner being, who is also me. It's just the me that's in non-physical form. And together we go through this life and, you know, explore and expand and get to experience, you know, and whether I don't have a label for that, except that's to me, well, I guess I would call that's life. That's what life is.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, being my inner being, just bouncing around and experiencing things.
Well, one of the things that I really liked learning from Abraham was the idea that when someone is basically pointing a finger at you and shaming you in some way, what they're really doing is talking about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought that just kind of summarizes beautifully what happens. Like the most common example that I can think of is someone who says, and it could be almost, it could be a parental figure, it could be almost any authority figure, but basically the message is you must behave in a certain way to please me. Mm-hmm. If you do not behave in a certain way to please me, I will be unhappy and you will not like the consequences of that. And that message makes it sound like you are the problem, and you're not. You're not even close to the problem. The problem is the person who's saying all that. They're projecting onto you what's really going on inside themselves.
Very true.
Once we understand that, once we appreciate it and pay attention to it and note it for what it is, I think a whole lot of the dynamics of cultural and social interaction change. Politics, for sure, that's the first thing that comes to mind, changes dramatically. The news changes dramatically just because of, you know, anybody who gets on a news channel and starts talking about these terrible things that person X and person Y and person Z are doing are really pointing at themselves. It changes the whole dynamic.
Well, I'm thinking about, you know, when we're very small, the things like when we're little, the things we're praised for, the things we get kudos for. As little ones, we take the kudos and almost create a rule out of it. So if you did something good, or if you did anything, let's say you pushed your chair in at the table when you walked away, and somebody said, "Oh, good, Peter, good for you that you pushed in the chair." There's a really good likeliness that Peter is going to go, "Oh, I get praised for pushing in chairs. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll do it again."
Right, sure.
And then if he does it again and again, and each time it's like, "Oh, you're such a good little boy because you're pushing in the chairs."
Mm-hmm.
He learns the rule: when I push in a chair, I get to feel good.
Yep.
Who knows? I mean, he could become an obsessive chair pusher. But, you know, that's the kind of stuff that happens. And so if somebody, like, it is so very common. How many times have you heard, you know, an adult meeting a child for the first time and they'll say, "Oh, you're such a pretty little girl.
Mm-hmm.
Look at your pretty hair."
Mm-hmm.
Well, then a little girl associates, my hair gives me kudos.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I have to always look pretty for people to love me. And I remember, oh, maybe a couple, 3 years ago, having heard somebody, I think it was on a television or a news program or something, where it was a woman, like clinical psychologist kind of type, you know, suggesting that when we meet people, in particular little children, that we don't call out things about their appearance. as good or bad, so that they don't start to associate that with what makes them an acceptable child or not. And so I've kind of been playing with that for the last couple of years, that when I do, like, you know, if I'm at a grocery store and there's a couple with, you know, children in front of me or behind me and the kid's acting up or whatever, you know, sometimes I'll try to get the child's attention. And I used to get their attention by saying, oh, you're so pretty or whatever. And it's like, okay, don't say that. What else can I say?
Yeah. You don't want to be the manipulative one.
Well, and it caused me to realize how embedded that kind of commentary is, because I found it kind of hard to find something else to connect with a child over. If it wasn't their looks, because that's the natural thing you see. I mean, almost all children look adorable to me, you know, but I don't just say, oh, you have such a lovely smile. That would have never occurred to me before.
I love the way Louise does it with kids. Louise is amazing with kids. I love the way she does it. We can be in like a grocery store in the checkout aisle, and there are like 50 checkout aisles, and they're all jam-packed. And one aisle over, there's a little one-year-old who's squirming in the shopping cart seat while mom is taking care of, you know, checking out and so forth. And you can just see the one-year-old is very close to having a tantrum or breaking out in tears or whatever. And all Louise will do is just look at the child and hold her focus there. And within seconds, the child's head will snap right over to where she is. And within a few seconds after that, he or she will start to smile. Even if they're on the verge of tears, the whole thing will turn around on a dime. And I remember the first few times I saw Louise do that, this is early on in our relationship, I asked her, what do you do? And she says, I just see them. And I thought, wow, what a profound thing to say. She doesn't look at their looks. She doesn't look at their smile. She sees them, and they know it. And to this day, it doesn't matter where we are. If we are in any kind of a crowd and there's a toddler within seeing distance of her, of all the people who will be around, all she has to do is look at the child, and the child will just snap their attention right at her, because they can tell she's just seeing them for who they are. And that's it. No strings attached, no reward system. Just, I see you for who you are.
That is like the culmination, summary, bestest thing I can think of in the whole wide world in terms of what is the measure of success.
Yeah.
Being seen for who you really are.
Just being
and
seen.
And owning it.
Yeah.
And being able to go, yeah, I am that person. Wow.
I mean, when you were talking about the reward for being, you know, the person, the little kid who pushes the chair in or whatever, or the girl who's rewarded for, you know, having pretty hair, what all those things do, obviously, is they treat the surface person. They don't treat the person inside. Can you imagine the same kind of damage that's being done today by well-meaning parents who constantly say to their kids, good job, good job. Good job is whenever the child does something the parent likes. Good job.
Mm-hmm.
And they have no idea they're doing damage. And to a certain extent, they're doing good things. That's what makes it really confusing. I mean, some of the things that they're helping kids learn are good things.
It may not be damaging at all. It's just, how does the child internalize it, and what do they do with it going forward?
Well, the only way, the way it's damaging, and it is fairly consistently damaging this way, is if the parent does not also recognize and love them just for who they are without attaching some sort of a requirement. The unconditional love rather than the conditional love. If there's unconditional love, then the damage is minimized. But if there's not unconditional love, then the damage becomes quite extensive and goes on for decades until it gets addressed directly.
Or not.
What do you mean?
Well, that could happen or not. That is a possibility.
Oh, yes. Okay, you're right. It doesn't have to be for decades. It doesn't
I'm just saying it's not an absolute.
Yeah, it's not
that
an absolute.
That is just one possibility.
But it's the tendency. Yeah. The tendency is definitely there.
I mean, I know when I went through school, being very left brain and being a firstborn, which typically ends up being a perfectionistic child.
Tell me about
it. I really excelled at school. What'd you say?
I said, tell me about it.
I excelled at school. Anything less than an A was, in my mind, just not acceptable. So it doesn't surprise me that I was a straight A student. And I don't look to anybody to like go, oh, wow, really? Because what I think of that today is that's just what I chose to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I was treated, you know, with kid gloves going through school. I mean, my teachers praised me, my parents praised me, you know, almost all adults praised me for having good grades. And, you know, that was cool then. But when I think about it in the bigger context of life, you know, the students that were alongside of me, you know, well, most of them actually were in accelerated courses just like I was. But let's just say those who weren't in accelerated courses, you know, it's not like they went on to be nothing in life, and that what the grade you produce, you know, through high school is what determines your value as an adult.
Right, sure.
It's like I see how there is such a fallacy in that.
Oh, yeah.
Especially when I got married and I got to know this man, you know, called my husband, mm-hmm. and his academic, you know, years were very different than mine. But I came to learn that he was a kinesthetic learner, and the school system did not cater to those who needed to touch and feel something in order to connect ideas in their head.
Yeah, that would have been
a rough one. When he would fidget, he was being reprimanded and told to just sit down and be quiet and sit still. Well, the very act of him sitting still turned off his brain function to listen and to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he got into things like mechanics or gaming or things where his hands were like engaged,
he'd love that.
I mean, we're talking incredible brilliance and genius coming out of him.
Mm-hmm, sure.
You know, and so I just kind of recognize how people are rewarded in a very bizarre way. But, you know, I love that what we just read with, you know, the Abraham text. It's like when you go inside and seek your own inner being to align with what does my inner being think about my success in whatever area I'm thinking about. Your inner being is always encouraging. Your inner being knows my inner being knows who I really am.
Mm-hmm.
And so my inner being is not going, so Wendy, you didn't get very far when you learned how to ski when you were younger, you know, because for me, skiing was kind of fun, but I got windburn
mm-hmm.
so severely on my face that, you know, I went through like 2 weeks of horrendous peeling and blistering.
Ouch.
And after that it was like, oh no more skiing for me, because, you know, I've got Swedish skin and it just doesn't do very well, you know, in the wind. Actually, it was wind that particular weekend as well as the sun. But my inner being doesn't look at me and go, you are a failure at skiing because you tried it for a weekend and then you gave up. My inner being's not talking to me like that.
No.
My inner being's like, that was a success because it was fun while I was doing it, mm-hmm. and I did have a blast.
Yep.
And I fell all over the place because I was a beginner. I fell a lot.
Sure.
But my inner being is always on my side, always rooting for me. But if I look to others to determine for me, you know, what they thought of my experience. Oh my gosh. All the adults were like, oh my gosh, Wendy, I feel so bad for you. You know, do you need salve for your face? What can I do? Maybe you shouldn't go out skiing tomorrow because it was a weekend thing. And I'm like, are you kidding? I want to do some more. It was fun. And they were telling me, no, I don't think this is a good thing for you. And oh my, and thank goodness my parents weren't there. I was with another family, and so I could kind of blow off what other parents told me.
Right.
And I went out and did the thing that was fun for me. But, you know, the point is, if you look anywhere outside of yourself to measure whether you're successful or not, you're not getting good guidance. Even if someone agrees with you, it's still not the best source. You always want to go inside. I always want to go inside. Because that's really the only measure of success that really matters.
It's also it's reassuring to me that that inner voice, the inner being voice, is always a positive one. That's a new concept for me this past year. But when I heard that, it helped me release some resistance. Really, I shed some stuff I've been carrying around, stress I've been carrying around without realizing it, simply because we do have, in a sense, multiple voices inside. There's the inner being voice, but there's also the subconscious mind, which is not necessarily the same messages that the inner being is giving. The subconscious mind, actually, more often than not, is, you know, echoing back stuff that we picked up from reality, so-called. And a lot of that, in the experience of many of us, is negative because of, you know, the high prevalence of negativity in society. So it was actually reassuring to me. I knew I had actually a really nice test. Now, I know now it's not a completely accurate test, but it was good enough. And the test is this. If the message was good, it was coming from my inner being. If the message was bad, it was coming from my subconscious mind. So now I knew which one to ignore.
Well, and I was going to say, being that I grew up excelling in academics, there was a expectation, and the expectation was from outside of me, from the voices outside of me. It was not coming from inside. The voices outside of me had an expectation that I should go on and do something really incredible in the world, worthy of my academic achievement.
Mm.
And so I've spent most of my adult life measuring myself against that, like, oh man, I didn't go and get any more college degrees. So, well, failure there. The thing that I want to do is personal development. But I don't want to go to a university to get a degree. Okay. Failure there. Mm. And all the different things according to how I viewed how success is measured by those that were around me, mm-hmm. or those that I choose to measure myself against. Mm-hmm. It was pretty much failure, failure, failure. And I've had to work really hard to recognize that that voice was not appropriate to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
That voice was wrong. But, you know, after listening to it for multiple decades, it's kind of ingrained in how I think. You know, and so learning how to tap into my inner being and recognize that my inner being's voice is the only one that counts to me, the only one. And my inner being knows that I'm an incredible success every day that I wake up and I feel a sense of kindness towards myself or others. That in itself is success.
Mm-hmm.
When I have a kind word to say to somebody or an encouraging, uplifting thing, that's a moment of success. And I feel that deeply. It makes me feel really good when I'm kind to somebody.
Sure.
Doesn't have to be a big thing. It doesn't have to be an academic achievement. It's just a simple act of kindness is sufficient.
It makes sense to me. I mean, I've been kind of noticing that by contrast through the mirror work that I've been doing, because quite evidently, I can tell for sure by now, most of my life, most of my self-talk toward myself has been pretty rough, pretty negative. And through the mirror work, I am making myself every day say nice, positive, loving things to myself while I'm looking myself in the eye in the mirror, which was tough the first few days. It's still a little bit tough, but it's not so bad now. But nevertheless, for the first time, I am consciously getting a different message from myself. And the contrast is huge. So just through seeing that contrast, I can totally agree with what you're saying about, you know, having the positive messages from your inner being and trusting what your inner being is telling you, because I find for the first time in a while, I'm actually starting to trust my own judgment. I hadn't been trusting it a long time. I had so many things that went wrong that I just didn't trust it. I'm starting to trust it now. Not a big way, but I'm starting to trust it. My own ability to discern what it is I want, what it is I don't want, and trusting that. I can trust that it's good. It's okay. It's a good thing. That's a lot for me.
That's a really huge win.
Yeah.
You could have started with that today.
I could have, yes. Except I can't pin it down to just today, but yes, it is a big win.
It is a big win. I mean, every day we look inside and ask our inner being to reflect back to us what our inner being knows about us. That's a good day.
Mm.
That's a good experience. That's one worthy of noting.
In fact,
you know, and when you do it over and over, it becomes, a practice vibration. So it's like easy for you to go back to it. And then momentum takes form. And then boom, it kind of happens on its own without you doing it on purpose.
Well, that's where I'm trying to get to. And in fact, I'm trying to figure out how can I sort of extend what I do in the mirror work to other parts of the day. I haven't really succeeded in making that mental leap yet, but I'm hoping one of these days I get like a spark of insight that says, well, you could always do this. And, oh, yeah, that would work, you know, that kind of thing. But if I could get to the point where, or I should say perhaps when I get to the point where I am giving myself that kind of message throughout the day, I can only imagine in a very faint way how big that's going to be. I think it's going to be gigantic, more than I can possibly measure. I just have to figure out how to get there.
Well, and I was going to say, first of all, your job is not to figure out how.
True. Yeah, cool, that's right. Right. That's the horrible house.
Yeah. I used to tell clients when they go, but how do I do this? I'm like, you're fired.
Yeah, right.
Like, what do you mean you're fired? What do you mean I'm fired? I'm like, you have been fired from the job of figuring out how.
How, right.
Because we hired a universal manager called Law of Attraction. It's their job to figure out the how.
That's true.
Oh, that's cool. So, you know, my gentle suggestion for you is to just go, yeah, I really want to feel this more often throughout the day.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's all you need to do.
I think I just
did,
actually.
You don't even need to do it, but that's... If you did that alone, Law of Attraction will go, okay, we know how to make that happen.
That is a very cool point.
So, yeah, just, you know, when you're focusing on what you desire, which is, I like this thing that I'm doing. Gosh, I'd like to feel this more often, or I'd like this to happen more often on its own.
That's
just stay in that state of curiosity and wonder of, ooh, I wonder what would it feel like if I was doing this like multiple times a day.
Yeah. That's so funny, though, because I really was not aware that I was asking how. Literally, I was just caught in that mode that, you know, we've all been in, because that's what we learned to do from the smallest age. How do I do that? You know, mommy, how does that work? You know, we learned that from the earliest age. So here I am just spitting it out again, hardly realizing what I was doing. Then you pointed out that I was addressing how. And as soon as you said that, I knew what you were saying. I knew what you were driving at. And I thought to myself, I did it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I didn't even realize I was doing it.
Well, and you know, that's the beauty of playing with the kinds of conversations we do in the presence of somebody who we both have the same goal, which is to feel good and to improve our lives even more.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you have pointed out things to me where I'm like, huh, yep, sure didn't see that. It was wonderful to have you be an objective viewer of my life to point out things for me. And I like to do that for you. That's the beautiful exchange.
Oh, absolutely.
That
yeah.
we have for one another. And hopefully other people can relate and go, you know what? I do that too.
Mm-hmm.
So they're pointing that out for me. Yeah. So
if
you're
just
listening
continue to be
and you can relate to trying to take on the heavy job of how, figuring out the how, this is our encouragement. You can let that go.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Law of Attraction has that one covered.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I just continue to be amazed all the different ways that stuff that, yeah, I thought I'd address just pops up every once in a while. It just says, here I am. I'm going to try to make your life miserable for the next 20 seconds. Oh, well. The good news is that every time one of them pop up, there's one less to pop up. they're just slowly peeling away over
well,
time.
Well, you know what, Walt? I know we're coming to the end of the show. And I don't know if I'm going to steal this from you, but I do want to announce that we have actually completed section 2 in the book.
We have.
Something that you have been dying for, at least verbally, you've been joking about it a lot, that we're almost done. And it's like, look, we let go of like trying to measure ourselves by where we are. And before you know it, poof, it happened.
Oh, that's funny.
So unless something else comes up for us on Monday, we'll actually begin with part 3, which is the science of deliberate creation. And we'll see what Abraham has to say about that.
Well, there's going to be a test. The test is going to be to see when I announce that we're continuing the exploration of the law of attraction, will I say part 2 or part 3? I could say part 2 because I've been saying that for quite some time now. But we will save that for next week. Because that's the end of this week. It's been great. Before we go, we always like to remind people, how does somebody reach out to our wonderful co-host who is a professional coach and is able to help people who need that personal attention? How do they reach you, Wendy?
They can find me at wendydillard.com.
And you always keep it so simple. I love that. Wendy, it's been a pleasure. It's been a great week, and I can't wait for doing it again next week.
It's been a great week, and I hope everyone else has a fabulous weekend, and we'll see you back here next week on Monday.
Absolutely. We hope you join us, because this show is for you, and we're here for you. That's why we do this. So join us next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye-bye now.